Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Peter Wilcox, captain of the Greenpeace ship Arctic Sunrise, who talks about his 2 months in Russian prisons, along with 29 other crew members, and the continuing fight against oil drilling in the Arctic and climate change. Sharon Levin of the National Women's Law Center, who assesses new health coverage for women under Obamacare and the effort by some employers to deny their workers mandated birth control due to their religious beliefs. And Monty Frank of Newtown Action Alliance, who discusses his group's ongoing campaign calling for stricter state and federal laws on gun safety, 1 year after the killing of 20 first graders and 6 educators at his town's Sandy Hook Elementary School. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Marathon talks in Northern Ireland collapsed on New Year's Eve amid the divisive issues of flags, parades, and investigating 3,000 politically motivated killings during the 30-year civil war in Northern Ireland known as the Troubles. The 5-party talks moderated by U.S. diplomat Richard Haass dealt with a new proposal to resolve years of violence around loyalist parades and the flying of national flags. Going into the final talks in Belfast, Haass was optimistic his draft proposal would be accepted, but talks fell apart as unionist political parties allied with Great Britain rejected the plan, while nationalist and centrist parties backed the deal. In the wake of the failed talks, Amnesty International has asked the 5 parties involved to publish their proposals to account for unsolved murders and human rights abuses during the Troubles. Last September, Amnesty charged that the current process to investigate these killings was inadequate and called for a more vigorous approach. Over the last decade, Bolsa Família, a social program in Brazil that gives small cash stipends to women in exchange for ensuring their children attend school and get medical checkups at local health clinics, has helped lift 36 million Brazilians out of extreme poverty. Bolsa Família has emerged as an international model for battling poverty, and the program is extremely popular among most political parties in Brazil. But now questions from the left and right are being raised about the program's long-term impact on economic inequality. Some observers maintain the money could be better spent on education, infrastructure, and pensions. Brazilian experts say the success of Bolsa Família is very limited in fighting endemic inequality. Academic researcher Talita Sousa Nascimento told The Guardian newspaper, "The cash transfer is just the first step. In Brazil, there wasn't any policies or politics for addressing poverty until Bolsa Família." But Maria Ozaneira da Silva of the Federal University of Maranhão is more skeptical, asserting that the cash transfer system maintains the status quo. She says it does not change the structural problem of concentrated prosperity. On the eve of the inauguration of Bill de Blasio as New York City's new mayor, thousands of city residents were living on the streets or scrambling to find shelter or food. Under outgoing Mayor Michael Bloomberg, the number of homeless people in the city had doubled since the 2008 financial collapse. As a candidate, de Blasio pledged to end the tale of two cities in the Big Apple. According to the Guardian newspaper, the number of homeless in New York City totaled an estimated 64,000 in 2013, which included more than 22,000 children living in emergency shelters. In the last year, New York City's homeless population has grown by 11%, while across the country, the rate of homelessness has fallen by 4%. During his campaign for mayor, de Blasio promised to reinstate rent vouchers for low-income residents living in private apartments. Many federal housing vouchers were frozen in 2010 after federal cuts, and Mayor Michael Bloomberg had refused to fill the gap with city funds. Now, making matters worse, Congress has slashed food stamps for the poor. As construction of dozens of luxury condo towers proceeds across the city, most New York renters are feeling the squeeze. In the last 4 years, A New York University law school study found rent rose nearly 9%, while income fell by 7%, creating a huge affordability gap that is an important factor in the increase in homelessness. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker.
On September 18th, members of the environmental activist group Greenpeace boarded and attempted to scale a Russian-owned Gazprom oil drilling rig in the Arctic Ocean. The Russian military responded to the nonviolent direct action protest designed to draw attention to the environmental hazards of drilling for fossil fuels in the Arctic by firing guns and brandishing knives. All 28 crew members of the Greenpeace ship Arctic Sunrise and two freelance journalists accompanying them were arrested by the Russian government. The activists and their ship were taken to the northern Russian city of Murmansk. Held in a Murmansk jail without bail, all members of the Greenpeace crew were originally charged with piracy, an offense that carries a 10 to 15 year prison sentence. Facing growing international protests, Russia later reduced the charges to hooliganism, which carries a 7-year jail term, and released the activists on bail. With the approach of the Winter Olympics in Sochi, the Russian parliament, or Duma, granted amnesty to thousands of political prisoners across Russia on December 18th, including members of the punk band Pussy Riot and the Greenpeace Arctic 30 activists. While the Russians continue to hold the Greenpeace ship Arctic Sunrise, all members of the Greenpeace crew from 18 different nations have been freed. Among those returning home after their imprisonment was Peter Wilcox, captain of the Arctic Sunrise and an active member of Greenpeace for more than 3 decades. Your reporter spoke with Wilcox, who was captain of the Greenpeace ship Rainbow Warrior when it was bombed by French intelligence agents in Auckland Harbor, New Zealand in 1985, killing one crew member. Here, Captain Wilcox, a native of Norwalk, Connecticut, talks about his 2 months in Russian prisons and his vow to continue the fight against oil drilling in the Arctic's fragile ecosystem and climate change.
Well, I really don't want to talk about the action itself very much because it's still under litigation. We're still expecting to arbitrate with the Russian state over what happened. I will say that we had done a slightly stronger action the year before, during which there had been no dramatic response from the Russians. So we were quite surprised when they did what they did, which included firing machine guns within a meter of our inflatables, slicing our inflatables up with knives, and then having special forces rappel onto the ship from a helicopter and arrest it. All of that was quite a surprise to us. We hadn't expected that at all.
Now, once you were arrested, you and your crew were arrested, you were in a jail cell for a couple of months, and I'm wondering what kind of thoughts went through your mind about the consequences of the action and what the Russian government was trying to accomplish with the harsh treatment.
Well, looking back on it with some hindsight, I think when they arrested us the way they did, they had in mind the amnesty program that finally went through in late December. Over 20,000 Russian political prisoners were released due to the amnesty program. It wasn't just ourselves and Pussy Riot and the oil tycoon. It was 20,000 other Russians. And I think that they had figured all along that this would be a good way to send a message to Greenpeace that they should not protest there. The difficult part about it wasn't so much the conditions, which were not particularly pleasant. When you're held in a Russian detention center, you're in a small cell for 23 hours a day. 1 hour a day you get to walk around in another cell, which has just a little more space in it. And it's not, you know, like I said, it's not very pleasant. The difficult thing for us was the piracy charge, which carries a 10 to 15 year sentence. And for all of us, that would be a major game changer. And as much as, you know, I would sit in the cell and say, I just can't believe they're going to do this, we didn't believe that they were going to arrest us in the first place because we were 30 people from 22 different countries. And then that night we were in jail. So there was a lot of anxiety, a lot of stress, a lot of nervousness on our parts, just because we had no clue what the Russians were going to do.
I wanted to just ask you about the overarching issue. The main issue that brought you to the Arctic Ocean was concern for the environment with Russia's moving forward with oil drilling in the Arctic. And I wondered if you would link that concern directly with global warming.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Scientists tell us that we have five times more oil than we need to push global warming over that 2 degrees Celsius figure. We already have more oil than we should burn. Pushing climate change up over another 2 degrees Celsius is going to unleash some horrible, horrible effects. We know that the more CO2 we pump into the atmosphere, the more the Earth warms. The more CO2 we pump into the atmosphere, the oceans absorb an equal amount and change it to an acid. So the Australian scientists I was meeting with last winter inside the Great Barrier Reef were convinced that within 20 years, the oceans would become so acidic that corals would not be able to form, plankton would not be able to grow shells, and we're going to change the basic chemistry of the oceans and kill off much of the life that's in it. So, you know, when I started working for environmental groups 40 years ago, I had no clue I'd be here at this point, you know, fighting for the future of my kids. But that's the way I feel is what we're doing. I've got an 18-year-old and a 22-year-old daughter and a 28-year-old son, and I'm scared for their future. I absolutely am. If you just listen to scientists, don't listen to politicians, listen to scientists. They will tell you, if they don't work for an oil company, that we can't go on living on the earth the way we are and hope it's going to support us. We have got to change what we're doing. The economic system we have set up that allows corporations to make billions of dollars doing something which is so destructive, we have to stop that. Enough of that. And we, the people, are the ones that are going to have to say that. We can't expect oil companies to stop on their own. They're just corporations. They're just money-making machines. They're not going to do it. We've got to tell them. That's what we're attempting to do.
That was Peter Wilcox, captain of the Greenpeace ship Arctic Sunrise. Learn more about the Greenpeace campaign against drilling for oil in the Arctic and climate change by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. January 1, 2014 marked the start date for several important provisions of the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare. And despite the shaky rollout of the federal website in the fall, more than 2.1 million Americans have signed up for private health insurance through the federal and state health exchanges. That's in addition to the 3 million young adults who've been able to retain health coverage under their parents' insurance policies, and the addition of 3.9 million Americans now eligible for Medicaid in the Children's Health Insurance Program in states that agreed to expand Medicaid eligibility paid for by federal funds. Several of the new health insurance provisions relate specifically to women. Reacting to Obamacare's mandate that both for-profit and nonprofit employers must cover the cost of birth control for their employees, the Denver, Colorado-based Little Sisters of the Poor, Home for the Aged, and other nonprofits asked the Supreme Court to halt enforcement of that provision. On New Year's Eve, Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor responded to the Little Sisters' challenge by issuing an injunction stopping implementation of the measure pending a response from the Obama administration. Under the Affordable Care Act, religious institutions are exempt from the mandate to provide contraceptives, but nonprofit religious-affiliated groups such as church-run hospitals, religious schools, and charities must either provide no-cost contraception coverage or have a third-party insurer provide separate benefits without the employer's direct involvement. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Sharon Levin, Director of Federal Reproductive Health Policy with the National Women's Law Center. Here she talks about the positive new developments for women under Obamacare and the possibility that the courts could deny women birth control coverage because their employers consider such coverage to be a violation of their moral beliefs and religious liberty.
There are a number of provisions in Obamacare that are really important to help women. One is a repeal of what is called gender rating. And basically, health insurance plans were charging women higher premiums simply because they were women. They were treating being a woman like it was a pre-existing condition. And Obamacare repeals that. As of January 1st, plans can no longer gender rate, which is really important because it means women and men will be treated equally. Another provision that went into effect is that plans can no longer charge more for people with pre-existing conditions generally. And that was a really important provision to help women and anyone with a pre-existing condition.
Can you explain the origin of the exclusion of coverage for those with pre-existing conditions? Those seem to be the people who need insurance the most.
Basically, health insurance is a little bit like legal gambling. Insurance plans want to get as many people, they want to bet when they take your policy that they're not going to have to pay out on your policy, right? So the money they get in from your premiums is all profit. Because if they have to pay out, then they're actually losing money. Their goal is to get as many young, healthy people into their plans as possible because they're betting then that they won't have to pay out. So if you get somebody on your plan that has a pre-existing condition, odds are you're going to have to pay out for them. You're going to have to pay for health care services because you already know they have a condition that requires medical attention.
Is including these previously excluded people from coverage going to raise rates for them or for everyone since they'll be using more health care?
It shouldn't. It depends on where they get their coverage. But in most group health plans, if you're getting your coverage through your employer, it shouldn't affect it.
Are there other aspects of the law that benefit women?
Another provision that's very important for women is a provision that went into effect in 2012 that requires a set of important preventive health services for women, including contraception, to be covered without cost sharing. And we have heard from women all over the country who are excited that they have been able to get their pill prescription filled, for example, without a copay, and they have sent us copies of their receipts from the drugstore that have a zero down for how much they were charged out of pocket.
That's really good news. But speaking of birth control, you know, there's been this big fight over which nonprofits, if they're religiously affiliated or even private for-profit companies that don't approve of birth control, which ones will be exempt from having to provide that coverage. And on New Year's Eve, Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor stayed the implementation of the requirement for one organization. Can you run down the different kinds of entities and how they can be exempt?
There are some employers who have objected to the contraceptive coverage provision because they claim it infringes the religious rights. And there are a couple of things to keep in mind about this. First, allowing an employee to use their own health benefits that they've earned as part of their compensation doesn't really impact the employer's religious rights. It's part of the compensation a worker has earned. And basically, bosses should not be making women's health decisions. A boss should not be able to decide whether or not a woman can use contraception. That's a decision a woman should be making with her health care provider. In addition, the employees have religious rights, and they have the right not to have their boss's religion imposed on them. You had asked about the type of employers, and there are really three sets of employers. The first is houses of worship. If you're a church or a synagogue, you don't have to abide by this rule. There's a regulation that exempts you. So churches don't have to provide contraceptive coverage to their employees. There's a second group, which are some nonprofits that were really created for religious purposes and hold themselves out as having a religious purpose. And they can be accommodated, which means they don't have to provide the contraceptive coverage. They have to let their insurance company know that they won't provide it, and then the insurance company provides it. And so that way, the women still get the coverage they need, and that's really the important thing. The third group of employers who have sued are for-profit companies who want to get out from this contraceptive coverage provision. And it's very dangerous that a for-profit company could be able to say that they don't want to abide by a law that was created to protect employees based on their assertion of a religious right. Because, as I said before, the employees have religious rights, and the government has an interest in protecting the health needs of employees. We have a lot of laws out there that protect employees, and it would be a very dangerous precedent if for-profit employers could just start opting out of them. And it raises some very important issues. Can a company have religious beliefs? And these companies were not created to further a religious belief. They were created to make a profit for their owners. Should a company that's in business to make a profit be able to opt out from laws that protect their employees? That's really the question at issue here.
That was Sharon Levin, Director of Federal Reproductive Health Policy with the National Women's Law Center. For more perspectives on the Affordable Care Act's birth control mandate, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. It's been little over 1 year since the unspeakable violence that claimed the lives of 20 first graders and 6 educators at Newtown, Connecticut's Sandy Hook Elementary School on December 14, 2012. Not long after family members, friends, and neighbors from Newtown and people across the country took time to mark that grim day 1 year earlier, Connecticut State Police released a final report on their investigation into one of the nation's most disturbing massacres and new details about the gunman, 20-year-old Adam Lanza. While advocates of common sense gun regulation have made progress passing new legislation enhancing gun safety laws in some states, including Connecticut, many have been frustrated in their inability to pass universal background checks and related measures at the federal level. The National Rifle Association, long seen as the most effective obstacle to the passage of new gun laws, once again demonstrated their powerful hold on legislators by blocking several modest new measures supported by both President Obama and a majority of Americans. Recognizing the continued difficulty of passing gun laws in Congress, the President issued 2 new executive orders on January 3rd that will better define which types of mental health treatment commitments will exclude specific groups of patients from purchasing guns and allow limited mental health treatment information protected by HIPAA laws to be submitted to the federal gun ownership background check system. Your reporter spoke with Monty Frank, a board member of the Newtown Action Alliance, who talks about his group's ongoing campaign calling for stricter state and federal laws on gun safety and ownership, 1 year after his town experienced the most painful year in its long history.
Well, I think we've made a tremendous amount of progress in the last year. Before 1214, gun violence prevention laws, it was really the third rail of American politics. No one was talking about it other than Senator Feinstein. And certainly no one was bold enough to try to bring forward new laws to combat gun violence. Since 1214, you know, we've taken the fight to Congress. The Senate had 4 bills, major bills in front of them, unprecedented bills. But for a fairly dysfunctional Congress and a filibuster rule, those 4 bills would have passed. And we would have, at least through the Senate, significant gun safety laws in place. So, you know, I'm fairly optimistic that over time we will obtain enough votes to defeat a filibuster on these bills. The support for background checks and trafficking laws has not subsided. It's still very strong. And so, you know, we're going to keep pushing forward, and hopefully Congress will become less dysfunctional and will actually look at, put politics aside and enact gun safety laws that will reduce the scourge of gun violence in our communities.
Monty, I know you're aware, and probably many of our listeners are aware, that the NRA targeted several legislators that supported, stricter gun safety laws in Colorado, and were able to recall a couple of those legislators. They lost their job as a result of the vote this past November. I'm wondering, you know, as you look at that, and the NRA obviously trying to send a message to legislators to not mess with gun rights or to intervene in these issues, an act of intimidation, to be sure. What do you come away from looking at that situation in Colorado? What did the NRA accomplish, if anything?
You also have to look at the situation in Rhode Island, where they recently targeted, in a recall election, some lawmakers there and lost. So, you have to look at the recall election for what it is. In any recall election, you get a small group. It's not always issue-oriented. There are other issues that were at play in Colorado and in Rhode Island. Colorado, they happened to recall 2, lost 1, and in Rhode Island, where they also tried to recall more recently, the recall effort was defeated.
what you're saying, it's a mixed bag, and no one should read too much into these couple of recall successes of the NRA, right?
No, and I think you also have to look at some of the polling data that emerged after the votes in the Senate. If you look at Senator Flake and Senator Kelly Ayotte of New Hampshire, after they voted against the gun safety laws, their approval ratings in those states plummeted. And other lawmakers, I look at Senator Manchin, for example, and Senator Toomey, their approval ratings skyrocketed. So, at a certain point in time, I think lawmakers are going to look at some of the polling data, both after those votes and across America, and get in line with what Americans overwhelmingly want.
I had read a recent report I wanted to get your reaction to. I think it was Mother Jones Magazine did this investigation and found that, tragically, 194 children, the average age of 6, had been shot to death since the killings in Newtown last December. And they took that research and contrasted it with the NRA's central message since last year, saying that more guns in the hands of adults will protect children. And their sort of dissection of the horrible deaths of these 194 children found the NRA's claims about more guns protecting these lives couldn't be less true.
More guns equals more gun violence. More gun violence equals more gun deaths. We have more guns than any other civilized nation in the world, and the rate of gun deaths in our country is so much higher than the rate of gun deaths in any other of the first world nations. For example, in Dublin, Scotland, in 1996, they had a mass shooting in a school. They enacted stronger laws, and since then, they have had zero mass shootings in schools. In the 12 months since what happened in my town, there have been 28 shootings in schools in the United States. What does that tell you? That the stronger gun safety laws work in reducing gun violence.
That was Monty Frank, a board member of the Newtown Action Alliance. Learn more about the Alliance and other groups advocating stricter gun regulation by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Liz Becker, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.